Hiya, and welcome to the Curb Podcast. My name is Andrew Pierce, and this podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Perth. I pay respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Sovereignty never ceded. On this episode, I talk with the filmmakers behind one of the most anxiety-provoking films of the year, Bird Eater. Jack Clark and Jim Weir are co-directors, with Jack writing the script for this story about a bachelor party that takes a horrifying and wild turn. Part thriller, part character piece, always intense, Bird Eater is a film that owes its existence to the legacy of the classic Aussie film Wake in Fright. In the following discussion, Jack and Jim talk about the influence of Wake in Fright on their film, while also touching on their desire to explore modern masculinity on screen. The pair also talk about the troubles they faced in making the film, and the genuine possibility that might not have been able to finish the production on it. There's a truly unsettling nature to Bird Eater, yet it's delivered in a massively captivating manner. Mark my word, you will be hearing a lot about these two filmmakers going forward. Bird Eater screens at the Melbourne International Film Festival on August 12th, 14th and 16th. And if you're looking for tickets for the 12th and the 14th, well, unfortunately, you're going to have to go on the wait list. Those screenings have already sold out. So pick up a ticket to the 16th if you're in Melbourne and eager to see it. If not, and you're in Western Australia, you can head down to Cinefest Oz on Saturday, the 2nd of September, where it will be screening at the festival. Here is a slice of the trailer for Bird Eater before Jack and Jim talk about the film. Jim starts the conversation by talking about the film's recent screening at the Sydney Film Festival.
You've been skydiving, Louis? I've been skydiving in Mexico.
Honey!
It was fun, but I didn't know that the planes that they take you up in, they don't have any seat belts. So you can go up in them, but you can't come back down. So when you're up there at 15,000 feet, it's the only way you're going out. Kicking, screaming, shitting, spewing, coming. They'll fucking choke you cold and throw you overboard. It's too late. Tonight we own you. The boys own you. And the harder you kick, the worse it's all gonna go down.
For you, how's the festival run been so far?
It's been good. Yes, Sydney was a bit of a whirlwind. It was weird going from talking about this movie for 3 years, but none of my family or friends had seen it, to overnight every single person I know had seen it. So that was kind of hard to adjust to. A lot of kind of had hundreds of like very similar conversations, but it was good. And it was great to meet some filmmakers as well. We became close with a few filmmaking teams who had films at Sydney.
Right, let's jump into talking about your great film. Let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is the very first thing that would be a huge influence on both yourselves as filmmakers, but also the film itself. And there's even a nice nod with the one sheet in there. But Wake in Fright, can you talk about the impact of that film on you both growing up as filmmakers and how it plays into the tone and vibe of Bird Eater? How is it an influence for this film?
Yeah, well, we came across Wake in Fright when we were at film school together. It was kind of one of our mandatory watches, and we had never seen it. It was sort of a shared first experience, and we were definitely rattled by it. There was something that appealed to us about the kind of the legacy of it as a lost film, but the way that it sort of really bluntly spoke to a certain type of masculinity in Australia felt very ahead of its time, that it was kind of reimagining the larrikin figure as a very menacing character in genre films. And I think we kind of parked the idea. We sort of absorbed it, and we had a lot to say about it. Wake in Fright's influence on Bird Eater just speaks to how much of an effect it's had on our masculine image in cinema, because we actually didn't start the film thinking about Wake in Fright. We started the film as a much more focused relationship drama. We were really just thinking about two people to begin with, and then the Bucks party setting felt like a natural mechanism to bring other people into the situation, make it a kind of a party premise. But as soon as we did that, we kind of realized that the baggage, that we were just sort of walking straight into the exact same territory that Wake and Fright has had such a dominant kind of presence in. So we had to, we were very glad to, but we had to kind of embrace that influence and really lean into a lot of the conversations that film was having about men. But we think that there's an element of Wake and Fright, and still in Australian genre films, that feels like there's a safe distance from Australian metropolitan areas. And I mean, we've done something similar where, you know, we're not the majority of our film is not set in, you know, Sydney, but there was something about the idea of young men from Sydney going, you know, an hour or two's drive out of the city and then kind of being overwhelmed by this, like the spectre of the Australian American, or the spectre of the sort of characters that you see in Wake and Fright, and questioning where that character comes from, and where, what is that innate mask that young Australian white men put on when they indulge in drinking or they indulge in festivities. And I think that that was something that we were really interested in exploring, and something that we want to keep exploring, because it's a strange, I think it's a strange phenomenon. It's very, very questionable.
I find it interesting, the search for what a modern man is in Australian film has been something that a lot of filmmakers, especially emerging filmmakers like yourselves, have explored in recent years, but also in short films like Mud Crab and Mate as well, which are both films that look at that tussle between men in different environments. One is about father-son, another is about, you know, small town. And here we're talking about a masculine environment, which is usually excluded from having any kind of female or women presence at all. And that is a distinct difference between these kinds of stories, that, you know, there is this kind of almost modern idea of bringing the women along on the Bucks night party. Where did that concept come from?
Well, like you're saying, it's the idea of bringing women to the party, in a way was bringing, it was almost like bringing a camera to the party in film, or like the men are aware that they suddenly have an audience, and just by that very fact they begin to sort of behave reflexively. They begin to be self-conscious about the mode that they're switching into, because I think we're at a real crisis point right now in those films you mentioned as well, in Mate and Mud Crab, where this idea of the masculine identity of Australia is at a crisis point with modern gendered politics, where it's no longer compatible with and is no longer healthy. But that's what colonial Australia has built so much of its personality around. So I think there's a real question now as to how the Australian male, the white Australian male, will reform themselves. And I think there's a lot of panic in that as well. That's something that we liked. We liked the idea of panic, that these men are expecting to be able to sort of get away and behave without any sort of responsibility, or behave in the ways that they, for some reason, want to behave without being reprimanded by it. But the fact of bringing like that contemporary gender politics to the Bucks party makes them freak out. Like, with, I think that's why we like Charlie quite a lot as well as a character, because we see him as someone who's just constantly melting down, because he hasn't come to a Bucks party expecting to be challenged in the way that he has been. And I think there's a lot of like unintentional humor there, or intentional and unintentional. But I know that Jack Bannister, who played Charlie, was not going in to the shoot expecting us to find his character so funny, in particular me and Jim. I mean, me and Jim find Charlie to be just very comic to watch, not necessarily like a comic character, but very, very funny to watch. And I think that took Jack quite a while to sort of calibrate. But I think it's the fact that he takes it so seriously that we find so funny. Like, he takes these sort of archaic ideas of gendered politics so seriously. That's where some of the dark comedy comes in.
And Jim, for yourself, anything to add there?
Yeah, I think we were particularly interested in men who put on a mask in their relationships, and then having this Bucks party setting with their partners present, specifically with Louis and Charlie, watching them kind of shift between modes with their girlfriend or fiance, and then with the boys. It's why one of our favourite scenes is Charlie being walked in on when he takes the ketamine pill and immediately switching masks and pretending that he's just looking after Murph. He hasn't taken anything. Yeah, seeing that in real time, the switch.
Kind of switch straight into gaslighting is really terrifying as well. But one of the things which I note is that, like, for a lot of people, doesn't matter if you're man, woman, or non-binary, you know, seeing a group of men is an anxiety-provoking thing, regardless of whether, you know, it's a harmless situation or something like this, which is supposed to be, on paper at least, a fun event. Can you talk about exploring that kind of anxiety of just seeing a group of men together doing things?
Yeah, I mean, that's something, again, that's it's such a potent thing to use on screen and for an ensemble as well, just that the idea of a ratio of there's like a larger group of men than otherwise. It's definitely partly based on an experience I had. I went to a Sydney private school and we had a rugby initiation night for the old boys. And it's probably one of the most uncomfortable experiences of my life because there were, you know, it was a group of 30 to 40 men, sort of 19 to 24-year-olds. And it was just the journey from the train station to the pub we were going to, where it was just this group of men that were anticipating a really big night. Like, a few of them had already been pre-drinking, but we knew that the night was going to be about very heavy drinking, like no holds barred behavior. There was so many men in the group had partners, but they were behaving already in a way that they wouldn't have been doing if they were around their partner. And I felt so upset in that energy because I could feel, you know, just moving from the train like to the pub, that people were avoiding us because there's just this undercurrent of violence. There's this undercurrent of aggression in that group. There's an expectation that something is going to happen, whether or not it happens. And I think that's something that lends itself to the Bucks Party premise. There's this expectation that something will happen. Somebody will do something really upsetting, or someone is going to be put in a very uncomfortable position, or somebody is going to spew, or somebody is going to overdose. Like, there's just the weight of that expectation, I think, drives men into a kind of a frenzy state. But also, and I think it's like the Australian genre and Australian exploitation films leads an audience to expect the worst in these sort of premises as well. So there's a lot of maneuvering there you can do when you are dancing around genres the way we do, in that we can kind of use those audience expectations and hopefully surprise them or hopefully pivot them in new directions. But there's so much groundwork there already done by, like, what men usually do in genre films in Australian cinema. The audience has a lot of baggage in the cinema, I think, watching that.
Yeah, it's the same with expectations around genre. If you have a group of characters going to an isolated property, we've seen enough movies to know that something really bad is going to happen when they're alone out there. In most movies, it will be some kind of supernatural or like slasher element. It would be violence, but we wanted to subvert that with the direction our movie goes. But I think, yeah, constantly being aware of expectations is something that we talked about kind of at every point in the story. Like, what's the audience? What would most movies do next? And let's pivot then.
What I also love is the comparison between smart and unsmart characters, where one character, say for example Louis, carries a level of self-awareness of how intelligent he thinks he actually is, and then you have somebody like Dylan who thinks that he's smarter than he actually is, but, you know, and our initial impression of him is like, this guy is going to be the vessel for whatever antagonism or violence or you know, potential threat that might occur. But we actually get a little bit of empathy as we experience time with him as it goes along, and it's balancing that empathy of understanding these are imperfect people. But I'm curious if you can talk about crafting smart characters and unsmart characters, or people who think they're actually more intelligent than they really are.
Well, that was totally our plan with Dylan, was to kind of introduce him in a way that an audience would really quickly think they have a read on how he's going to fit in to the rest of the film, but then countering exactly what you're saying, that kind of the subterfuge of Louis's behavior, or that kind of the distance that we have from him, where we understand he may be doing things quite poorly, but we know that there's a performance there. Whereas we can see with Dylan, there's a certain honesty in his behavior, that whether or not we agree with his actions, I think an audience, and that has been a fairly unanimous experience, that audiences have grown closer to Dylan than they expected, because I think because of the honesty or the lack of mask that Dylan has, lets people in more than Louis. But our plan with him was to really lead an audience to expect a fairly straightforward antagonism from him, and then hopefully sort of pivot him into something else in the second half and allow Louis to sort of switch places there. But we kind of view a lot of our characters as pretty stupid. Not stupid in the sense that we like really poor grammar structure for dialogue. We just think that there's really funny deliveries that can come from that. But we just think it lends a level of authenticity to these characters as well. It means that when people are doing things that are really awful, or we're watching Louis kind of construct something that might seem like a really twisted Machiavellian idea of he's trying to architect this entire night, but when he kind of stumbles over his words, I think that lets an audience see the kind of the cogs turning in his head, and it sort of sees him trying to build those train tracks in front of him as the plot is going along, and I think that lets us humanize with him a little bit. And I think it's an intelligent thing. I think we relate it to like intelligence, the way people construct plans as they're happening. But I think we like to kind of always make those plans a little bit messier, even if they're strictly antagonistic, just because, yeah, I think it lets an audience in a bit further. Do you want to talk about that at all, Jim?
Yeah, I think it's less about intelligence, and it's more to do with crafting characters who have these extreme blind spots or extreme tunnel vision, and then pushing them into situations where you get a really clear sense of what those blind spots are, which is kind of a stupidity, but usually it's balanced by them having a really specific point of view or a really specific goal in mind for the night. So I think it's Dylan, it's less, you know, he's emotionally unintelligent and doesn't understand relationships, doesn't understand Louis and Irene, and more that the Bucks night is for him and he wants to have the best night possible. It's more that kind of tunnel vision.
Are you both, when you've got your script, are you really sticklers for actors sticking to the written word on the page, or is there a space of freedom that they can extend or expand on what you've written?
Yeah, it depends on the actor. They're all quite different, especially, you know, we only had seven people, but everyone seemed to have a fairly different approach to the scripted material. Some people were coming right out of the gate and had a very, very loose approach to the written words, and some who were really, really wanted to get one or two in the bag that were very closely on script, and then there'd be a kind of inherent permission from that point to experiment. I think that was generally our plan, was to sort of, that's sort of what we like to do. And that was a plan sort of across the board, which was that, especially on a low budget, you have to plan to an extent. You sort of know what you need. You know what needs to be said in the scene, and you just want to sort of make sure you've got it. And you think you want to make sure you've shot the scene the way you think you need it. But very quickly it becomes apparent if experimentation is needed. And I think different characters demanded different levels of improvisation as well. I mean, somebody like Irene, where like all of her dialogue is so measured and so calculated and needs to be so specific that every word is loaded and that the audience is like leaning forward. That with Shabana, that came down to, yeah, literally like word choices, single words that didn't feel right to her, or single words that we really wanted to keep because we felt like they were loaded, versus somebody like Dylan, who's, you know, just constantly rambling, and you're using his kind of diegetic or his kind of his outtakes, you know, just in the background speaker for like a chaotic scene at the end or something, Ben was often just like wheeling off. We'd just like set up a microphone and he'd just like talk for a while. We'd just use it in whatever way we wanted. So it was a real mix. It was quite hard for Alfie because we pushed the grammatical mistakes. It wasn't grammar mistakes. He would use turn of phrases in weird ways as Murph, and that was written. But Alfie quite likes to improvise, and so he would improvise on the already improvised turns of phrases, and they would become almost impossible.
Yeah.
So yeah. He actually had quite a short lead.
Yeah, it was largely just how much time we had in a day. If we had a bunch of time to shoot a scene, we'd always improv towards some of our later takes. We love taking actors away in between takes and giving them like a secret new line to throw the other actor off. Yeah, because we had two big delays before we started shooting because of COVID. So by the time we got to set, like the actors knew the script so well. And that can be really dangerous when an actor thinks they can nail a scene. It can become too measured. There's not enough room for sparks or something interesting to happen because, you know, the scene is so cemented in their mind. So when we had scenes like that, whether it was like a new line or a new way of playing it or a new type of blocking, would try to bring something new to it.
So how long did you shoot for and what did you shoot on as well? Because the visual style of the film is, you know, adds to obviously how intense and how captivating and engaging it is. So the visual style is really powerful. But yeah, how long did you shoot for and what did you shoot on?
We shot for 4 weeks initially, mostly on location near Wiseman's Ferry, which is a couple of hours out of Sydney. We were filming at the start of like a big weather event where there was a bunch of rain in the area, and we were filming at a property that was, you literally had to cross a stream to get to the house. So as we were shooting, the stream turned into kind of knee-deep and then waist-deep. It eventually became like a raging river one day. We had to have an emergency evacuation and we couldn't shoot there for the rest of the 4 weeks. So at that point, we realized there was no way we were going to finish in 4 weeks. One of our actors left as well, actually. So there was a different actor playing Dylan originally. And then we shot what we could with, you know, smaller scenes. A lot of those scenes when they're getting firewood, we were able to shoot, but we couldn't shoot any ensemble scenes. And then we had to kind of we had to refinance the film from scratch. We had zero money. And then 5 months later, we got another 2 weeks to shoot. We got a new actor to play Dylan. We filmed all of our ensemble scenes, all of the scenes that had Dylan in it. Yeah, so it was kind of like six and a half weeks total.
We shot on a Arri mirror, which was DP Rogers' camera, which he bought for the shoot. But it actually bricked a week in as well, so we had to get a replacement for that. But we also worth mentioning that first block when we were shooting what we could when we were still at Wiseman's Ferry, we were just shooting that in the property of the hotel that actors and crew were staying at.
That's right. Yeah.
We just went behind the accommodation because we were just rapidly running out of options, and so we had to kind of hide from the golf carts that were like the hotel, like the accommodation staff. Just because I didn't think they knew that what we were doing. But it really came down to that level of like, where can we shoot?
And then there were days where we were just like running out of scenes that we could shoot because we didn't have Dylan, and Dylan was in so many scenes. So we'll just film like cars driving in the rain, not knowing what would need for. But they ended up becoming like so useful in the edit.
Crucial.
When we had this emergency evacuation and we lost an actor and we ran out of money, it was kind of all happening at once. We like discussed just like throwing in the towel, making some kind of proof of concept and trying to get financing for like a new film. Just Bird Eater's not happening. It's a cursed production. We move on. But then eventually we were committed to the idea that we'd be able to refinance the film. And I think we were 2 weeks out from our second shooting block, still with literally $0 in the bank. when an angel investor came in and bankrolled the shoot block. So we were really, really, really lucky. Almost wasn't mad.
None of that shows on screen the stress and tension. It looks like $1 million, so it's good.
That's good. Yeah. On the camera question, though, we should shout out Roger as well, because Roger shot it on his Amira, and he was oftentimes either supported by one or two very dedicated, like, grips, gaffers, ACs, sort of combinations, and oftentimes he was, like, completely on his own. So he ended up being such a crucial part of the whole production that we were always able to sort of lean on, that we always had like a camera basically ready to roll whenever we needed, which is an incredible resource for such a small film. And we can only have Roger to thank for that, because I think if we'd had a much stricter camera package or a much stricter relationship with our DP, I don't know that the film would have been made at all. But I think the fact that Roger was kind of always in the wings with the camera, that was just like ready to shoot, and we knew that he would do the work, that gave us so much freedom and gave us so much extra footage than, you know, we otherwise would have been able to get away with. So,
as I was saying, the visual style of it is so, it's so powerful and strong and relates to the text itself and the performances brilliantly. It is really one of the finest Australian films, both visually and textually, that I've seen in a very long time. Blown away by it. Like, there's the praise has got to be very good. The responses that I've had from other people who watch a lot of Australian films has been like, you guys need to watch Bird Eater. You got to watch it. It's just like stunning. What does that mean to you guys as filmmakers, emerging filmmakers, to have that kind of immediate response where it's like, this is something you cannot miss?
It's awesome. Yeah, it's great. I think we're really stoked. Yeah, we're really glad it's being like received in the way we wanted to. We set out with like a lot of intentions, not really sure if people were going to get it. We're going to like buy into the type of movie we wanted to make, but people have been. So yeah, we always set out for Bird Eater to just be successful enough that me and Jack could make another movie. And I think, hopefully, yeah, it's gotten to that stage now where we're going to be able to make another movie. So that's all we really, really wanted.
Yeah, we were surprised. It's a relief to see that people are willing to see films that aren't super classifiable in a single genre as well. That's something that we didn't face any pushback in pre-production, but there were definitely questions about, you know, how to categorize this film, how to sell this film. And we were lucky enough to have people that supported the idea to begin with. But it was definitely a question mark in terms of what is the audience for this film. But it's been a relief to see the way that the audience has really latched on to that uncertainty of genre in a really fun way, because that's something that we want to keep experimenting with, because it's something that we enjoy. You know, I think that uncertainty can really excite an audience, like in the moment. It leads to a lot of people not having any idea where, you know, a film's going to turn. But it's also exciting to see there's a lot of other Australian films that are coming out recently that it feels like we're really part of a sort of a cohort at the moment. We were really inspired to see James Warne's film, Friends and Strangers, a few years ago. There were some great Australian films at Sydney this year. And yeah, people talking about similar things in, you know, Mudcrab and whatnot. So it feels like there's a lot of people that really turning a corner for Australian cinema, which is nice to see.
Well, that's it. Like that's as we lead into wrapping up there, that's one of the things which I've observed is there has been, as you're saying, this group of filmmakers, which are not just from one region. You know, there are filmmakers from Adelaide, Sydney, you know, WA, all over, that are operating kind of on their own regard and creating something that is showing this great emergence of really impressive Australian talent coming forward. Do you engage in Australian films and discuss and talk with Australian filmmakers much? Is that something that you're passionate about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's what's most exciting me about getting Bird Eater out into the world, I think, is being able to connect with other Australian filmmakers, because I think there's just so much potential here in the landscape, in the history, in the in social history, the national history, Indigenous history. There's so much potential here for stories that we're not seeing on screen, that I'm just desperate for people that aren't myself to dig into places that I can't, but I know there's so much that I, you know, that we're looking at that we're so hungry to depict, because we just don't see on the screen that much. I mean, people go crazy when there's a movie that's just set in Sydney, just because they want to be able to see Sydney yeah. on a movie screen. It doesn't matter if it's like a terrible movie. It's just like that we're just not scratching that itch at the moment. So I'm so excited by the idea that other people are sort of spreading into corners of this country that I can't go, and but making stories that I want to see. So I'm excited for an international audience. I'm very interested to see how an international audience receives it. And it's nice to see that I think people are hungry overseas for Australian content. I think there's still a level of exoticism about Australia that helps us, and I'm very thankful for that. But ultimately, I'm excited to see what these other filmmakers can do, and the sort of the conversations that we can spark each other to have, because I think that's what will generate interesting content, is if we're all asking questions about each other's work and driving each other into sort of new, to sort of define ourselves sort of naturally without directly challenging each other, you know, not in a confrontational way, but I think there's kind of a natural division that will happen. And we'll want to define ourselves a little bit more specifically once these people start making second and third films, and I think it will lead to really interesting places.
Yeah, I'd echo all of that. I think, and also just the talent. I think me and Jack know way too many talented filmmakers who are only getting commercial work because it's so hard to get fiction stuff off the ground in this country and in New South Wales in particular. So yeah, I think we're really hungry to make more of our own stuff, but we also want to lift up the people around us and the talent around us so more filmmakers can be making more films. In particular, yeah, feature films. That's what me and Jack are really interested in, and that's what we don't see enough of.
I'm excited to see where your career goes from here and what your catalogue of films looks like going forward, and obviously touching base every couple of years and, you know, talking about where you've both grown as filmmakers will be really exciting to see. There is so much to talk about this film. I do want to point out, like, the sequence with Carolyn McQuaid is just, that's one of the most stunning scenes I've seen in years. It is, like, it's on level with, you know, some of the scenes in Animal Kingdom, like Ben Mendelsohn dancing to a song and stuff like that. That's the level of unsettling nature in that particular scene is just insane. So congratulations for creating one heck of a film. It is something that you're going to be talking about for a long time, I imagine. So congratulations to you both.
So thank you. It's been lovely chatting. But Caroline should get a lot of credit for that, because she didn't have any rehearsals. She was just there the night and she just had to do it. So
special shout out to our sound designer, Julian Oliver, who also did all of the music and yes. weird soundscapey stuff for that sequence. I think all of it, well, not all of it, but most of it comes down to the sound in terms of unsettling the final product is.